Hi, I'm Dawson Church, your host for the Tapping Peak Performance Series. I am so excited to share these breakthrough programs with you, and I look forward to powerful shifts in your level of personal performance as a result. By listening to this program, you agree to all the terms of the disclaimer, which you can find at disclaimer.eftuniverse.com. Now let's explore the next insightful topic in the series together. Pam Grout is the author of the breakout bestseller, E Squared. It contains 9 thought experiments you can do to demonstrate to yourself that your thoughts really do influence your reality, and often in record time. Pam is a world traveler, a loving mother, a best-selling author, and an inspiring witness to everyone she meets. Before her success with E Squared, she was primarily a travel writer and published in many magazines, including Travel and Leisure, Family Circle, Scientific American Explorations, The Washington Post, The Detroit Free Press, and First for Women. Pam, I am so delighted to have you as a guest, and I'm intrigued by this whole idea that you express so eloquently and with so many funny and wise examples in your book, E Squared. So thanks for being here, and thanks for dramatizing this huge central idea of manifestation so beautifully in the book.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So go ahead and tell us that central premise that you cover in E Squared.
Well, I don't know if there's one premise, but I mean, the basic premise in the first experiment is the fact that we are all connected to everything in the universe, and that whatever we put our attention on is what shows up in our life. So I guess the biggest thing, if there is this great force in the universe, this incredibly loving, wise, although invisible energy that loves us all, but it always has our back. It also shows us out here in the world exactly what we're thinking. I mean, it's like, it's here for our viewing pleasure. Everything that we're thinking is, you know, shows up in our world. So it's really important, first of all, to get it that this force is out here. And secondly, to get it that this force is really loving and wants nothing but good for us. And then thirdly, to realize, you know, just how powerfully you are connected to it and how it does show up in your life. Exactly what you're thinking. And so once you start consciously using this force and thinking in a more positive way and really watching your thoughts, you can really radically change your life.
So once you accept that premise and start to think that way and then start to notice what shows up around you, you've got this reinforcement loop going where you have the thought, the thing shows up, and then that thing showing up is reinforcement of the principle of your thoughts then are able to shape the world around you.
Exactly. Yeah. Everything that we're thinking is, you know, again, showing up in our world exactly how we're thinking about it. The thing is, we have so many different thoughts. And even though we think, oh, I would like to have some Jaguar or whatever. We also have the thought, well, I don't know for sure if I can afford that. I don't know for sure if, you know, I deserve that. So we have all the other thoughts that tend to play out as well, because we have so many thoughts and we keep repeating the same thoughts over and over and over again. And that's really why we're seeing kind of the same old thing in our life. So the more we can really get our thoughts or our ducks all flying in the same direction, the more we can get exactly what we're wanting. And again, to really trust that, you know, that love is the bottom line, and love is the reason that we're here and the reason that, you know, that all this stuff does happen for us.
How did you first come to that realization?
Well, I use these principles a lot in my own life. You know, I'm a kid that lives in Kansas, the middle part of the country, and I've managed to do all these amazing things. I mean, I've been to all the continents except for Antarctica, but I'm going to be going there soon. So I travel all over the world. I've written for a lot of big magazines, so I do a lot of really cool things. And I've done that by believing, A, that you know, I'm deserving of doing those things, and B, I know about these principles. If you continue to focus on that kind of thing, that's what you can make happen for you. So I was using them so successfully in my own life that I decided, you know, this is something everybody needs to know. So I wrote the book, and I set it up in a way that really convinces people, because, you know, you hear about these principles, and we've all heard about these principles. I mean, going back to Jesus's time, I mean, these are principles, you know, like attracts like, what you think about, you know, asking you shall receive. All these kind of principles have been around for a long time, but they're kind of theories for people. So what I did in this book was to turn them into these 48-hour experiments. I mean, this is where you can see very demonstrably, very hands-on with your own eyes that, wow, this really does work. So it starts with these really basic, simple experiments, and people can see that this really works, and then you can just continue to build on that.
Give us an example of a big one, a really big example of somebody taking this approach and then seeing some kind of massive shift.
Oh, I hear from people all the time. In fact, the most exciting thing about having written this book is that I get these emails. I mean, I get evidence and proof every day in my inbox. So it's so exciting for me to, you know, wake up and read whatever new manifestation happened for somebody. But the biggest thing, the thing that's most satisfying for me, is the messages I get from people that say they're really changing their septic thinking. You know, they're really realizing how important it is to be positive and to trust that the world has their back and that it is a generous, abundant universe. So people that are starting to change their thought, I mean, from there, miracles are just, you know, going to start flowing in. So that's the most exciting for me. But as far as a concrete demonstration, I mean, everybody in this culture seems to really think money's a big one. So I did have one person who was given a gift of $100,000 in, I think she said, 5 days. So that's a pretty amazing thing that a lot of people can relate to and go, oh, I want that too. So, but the gifts have been across the board. I mean, the kind of things that people are, you know, drawing into their life. I mean, the first experiment that I ask people to do is to say, hey, I'm not asking for anything specific. I just want a little bit of proof. I want some clear sign that you have my back. And so people are getting all kinds of signs from that. So that's really been a lot of fun. But I mean, in fact, I've got a chapter in my new book. It's called Well Duh, and it's all about all the different things manifested. So it's really pretty funny. I mean, it's not everything. Obviously, I couldn't put everything in there, but I did do a whole chapter to kind of, you know, I think people like that. I sort of joke and call it a chicken soup for the manifestor soul, but it has all these really great stories. Because when you find out that one person did it, it's like, well, maybe I can do that too. So I think we really learn a lot from hearing stories of what other people have done and what is possible. Again, anything is possible, but you have to get your mind around it. So the more stories you hear and the more you learn about what's happening for other people, then the more you realize, wow, that could be possible for me too. So I'm big about sharing stories and anecdotes. I think that's really important.
It is important. And you also have people start out small by doing something that might convince them if they're skeptical. And it is too significant to be a coincidence. So you want to have people to find something small initially, try this out, and then build from there.
Right. Yeah. Some of the little baby steps are good. One of the experiments in the book, I mean, I guess if we're talking about the book, that is really mind blowing. I don't know if you've tried this one yet, but the one with the Einstein wands, and that's where you take two coat hangers or any piece of wire and you make them into these little wands, and then you put them out in front of you and you watch what happens to them as you think different thoughts. And this just blows people away. I mean, it works invariably. I mean, a lot of people have made these wands. They've taken them down to their bar, you know, to show for party tricks. I mean, this is really a powerful thing, and you cannot doubt it once you see this happening. You know, when you're thinking positive thoughts, these wands just open up. You know, they just open up and send loving energy out into the universe. When you think negative thoughts, they go in and they cross each other. So it's really pretty amazing.
You know, I actually did not do that experiment, Pam. I did some of the others, and one of them actually was manifesting this interview with you, because I had the spot open up in the lineup for the symposium, and I thought, you know, I'd love to interview Pam Grout, and that was 2 weeks ago, and just effortlessly, and with this chain of events that happened. So that was mine. Now the Einstein one, I have to say, and this is a kind of a confession of mine, is I am still a skeptic. I'm both a believer and a skeptic. So even though I do a lot of randomized controlled studies, I've written many scientific papers, I see the evidence in front of me that comes across my desk from the lab, I see this happening in these objective ways. Part of my skeptical mind is never convinced. I see people heal in the most amazing ways, and then my left brain is still saying, well, it won't happen next time. I've never been able to still that voice, that skeptical voice.
Well, I think we all have that voice to a certain degree. I mean, I just think that's part of it. But the more you focus on the other voice, the voice that says anything is possible, and I get a lot of oh, I don't know, comfort, I suppose, from the fact that quantum physics is really proving this over and over and over again out there in the world. So for those of us that are skeptics, and again, I think all of us have those skeptical voices, there is so much proof coming in now, you know, through the research journals. And so even though we've known it and seen it for, you know, centuries, now we're getting actual scientific proof. And it does help that skeptical side of us when we get those kind of studies coming in.
Yes, it certainly does. And so you at least have some mind share for the trusting voice as well as that skeptical voice. You have both of them going on at the same time.
Right. And I try to put more weight into the trusting one. In fact, the more I trust it, the bigger that bucket gets. You know, it's almost like there's this, you know, scales, and that, you know, you can feed that scale. You can keep putting rocks on the doubting scale, or you can put the rocks on the believing scale. And like I said, this book has really helped me put, I mean, you know, now my scale is practically, you know, the believing scale is practically hitting the ground, and that skeptic scale is way up. It's like, okay, I barely have any more of that skeptic side left anymore.
Yeah, and again, that's the analogy from Native American traditions of the black dog versus the white dog, and the dog that wins the fight is the dog you feed. So when we feed our positive thoughts and our expectations of the possibility that these things can manifest, then that is far more likely to happen, because that's the part of our mind we're paying attention to.
Right, exactly. I always kind of compare it to, you know, those old computer games. My daughter had a computer game when she was little, and there'd be little different doors, and wherever you put your cursor, you know, you'd open, that little door would open up, and you might see, you know, mice dancing together. You put the cursor on a flower pot, and all the petals would come down. So whatever you put your attention on comes alive, or whatever you put your cursor on comes alive in your life. So some of us still put our cursor on the, you know, the monsters under the bed. So some of us still believe in that. In fact, that's probably the state of the world that we see. But the more and more of us that are starting to put our cursor, our attention on all the possibilities and all the positives, then the world can completely change. And that's what I'm all about, is changing the dominant paradigm. I mean, I do think we will flip it over. I really believe in that 100 monkeys thing. So I really think that, you know, as the more and more of us become aware to this and start using this, you know, the quicker our world is going to flip over to all we're seeing is the love and the joy and, you know, the truth about the way the world is.
If I can just ask you a bold question, it might be, how quickly do you think that might happen?
You know, I don't know, but I see evidence all the time. I mean, in my own life, again, I believe the outer world is a mirror of what's going on in the inner. And so in my outer world now, I'm seeing so much evidence of all the love and the joy and the connection. And so to me, it could happen overnight. I mean, that's how quickly it could happen. But I really don't know for sure. And I don't know that anybody really knows. All I know is the part that I can continue to focus on and continue to look for. I have a thing every day where I feel like I'm Lewis and Clark out scouting blessings and miracles. I mean, that's my job, is to go out and look for blessings and miracles. And so, of course, they come flooding into me constantly. So I feel like that's an important part of my task, you know, is to be one of those people that is out there, you know, looking for that particular thing, putting my cursor on joy and love and expansion and abundance, as opposed to some of the other lessons that we might see in the media or, you know, again, the dominant paradigm of doom and gloom.
So when you're trying to do that, when it's your intention to do that, when you're determined to do that, and yet your mind still keeps defaulting to the doom and gloom, how can you shift it?
Well, one of the things I say in the book, it's like housebreaking a puppy. You just keep taking it outside and showing it, you know, this beautiful world outside, the natural world. You know, you just keep taking your puppy outside until he gets the message. And that's how I feel about my mind. I'm a student of The Course in Miracles. And literally anytime you notice, you know, you ask for help to see the truth that the world is abundant and generous and beautiful. So you just continue to ask for the truth to show up. And of course, the more you ask for it and the more you look for it, the more it will show up.
I love the part of the book where you talk about your own experience of feeling beautiful as an adult and a child and the struggles you've had growing up around that. It's a very personal story, but I was wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing it with us.
Yeah, well, when I was born, you know, my dad, I was pulled out with forceps, kind of that era. They were doing a lot of that with the doctor. So my nose was literally flattened against my face. And my dad, you know, he's a young dad. I think he was 21, 22, something like that. I mean, he didn't know too much about parenting or anything like that. And he takes one look at me laying there, you know, in my mom's arms or in the bassinet or wherever I was, and said, "Oh my gosh, that's the ugliest baby I have ever seen." Well, you know, you don't hear that indictment, you know, as a minutes old human being without having it affect you. So interestingly enough, my family, I was the only person in my family. There were, you know, three kids in my family, my mom and dad, the only one that wore a retainer. You know, my teeth were crooked, so I wore a retainer. I was the only one that needed glasses. So of course I was wearing these little pop bottle glasses, you know, back in junior high. And, you know, so I had a lot of stuff around, oh, I'm the ugliest baby my dad's ever seen. So I sort of created that in my own physical experience. And again, you can't argue this was genetics, because no one else in my family had glasses. No one else in my family had crooked teeth. This was just me. So I believe that, you know, possibly I created that because of this, you know, this first statement. This was the statement to rule my life. But as I got into more of this metaphysics and began changing my view of myself and focusing on the beauty within myself, well, I did have the retainer, so my teeth went straight, but my eyes went back to normal. So all kinds of things happened that overcame, you know, that early indictment that I was the ugliest baby my dad had ever seen.
Yeah, and when you start to have one thing shift and pay attention to it, then you tend to notice others. You call that the Volkswagen Jetta principle in the book. Explain that concept.
Oh, so again, whatever you focus upon expands. And so what the experiment I ask people to do is to pick something simple and to, for 48 hours, look for that simple thing. And one of my favorite stories is about, one of the things I suggest, look for a feather, a blue feather, or look for a particular color of car. I've had so many stories. People tell me, I can't even turn them off now. I see butterflies everywhere. Or butterflies, that was another one. So I've gotten all kinds of butterfly stories. But one of the girls, and I've told this story several times, she decided to look for white feathers, and she did, you know, what I recommend, set it and forget it. So, you know, she thought, okay, I want to see white feathers in the next 48 hours. She and her family went out geocaching over the weekend, which is when the experiment she was doing it fell. So as they were driving home, the traffic suddenly slowed down. They were on the interstate, and her daughter says, "Mommy, look, somebody must have killed a chicken." And lining the highway for about 4 or 5 miles, there were white feathers, like a foot of white feathers, you know, on both sides of the highway. She said, "I don't know if a mattress truck overturned or what, but there were, you know, 4 or 5 miles, both sides of the highway covered in white feathers." So they get past that part, you know, slowly inching along with the traffic. The traffic clears up. They zoom on home. And there on their welcome mat is one white feather. And she said the message she got from the universe was that it said, "Hey, I can do so much more than you ever ask for." So anyway, that was kind of a cool story. But I've heard so many stories about butterflies. One guy decided to look for clowns. I say, just look for something simple. But anyway, he says that, "How do I turn the clowns off?" He says every time he opens an in-flight magazine, he sees a clown. Every time he and his wife get in the car, the song Clown by Emily Sandy, I'm not sure how you pronounce that name, comes on. So it's like now he can't stop seeing clowns. So by picking something simple like that, you draw that into your awareness. Before that, you might not have even noticed, you know, that. You wouldn't have noticed the white feathers. You wouldn't have noticed the clowns. But once you start looking for it, that's what you notice. And the same exact principle, of course, works if you're looking for blessings and miracles, or if you're looking for what might go wrong. I mean, the number one question everybody asks is, what's wrong? What's wrong? I have a couple of groups I'm in here in my hometown of Lawrence, Kansas, and we always start with this question, what's going right? And it has completely revolutionized the conversation. You know, when you start asking what's going right, it changes everything. And these groups, and that's another big recommendation I have, is that people do this in groups. I mean, if you do it together, you know, we square the energy by working together. And so it's really important for all of us to be doing this together, all of us that believe this way, that feel this way. And so I feel like the energy is, you know, expanding at a rapid rate. When you ask that question, when's it going to turn over? I mean, from all evidence I see, it's going to happen within my lifetime, but certainly within my daughter's lifetime. She's 20 now. So
that's very encouraging. And you mentioned energy, and you have this whole chapter on people as energy beings. Go ahead and just share that with us, how we are beings of energy and where you get those ideas from and how we can apply them in our lives.
Well, actually, it was Einstein that first said everything is energy. You know, things look like solid, solid body. It's actually vibrating waves of energy. Everything we see, every rock, every flower, everything, and physics, again, quantum physics have proven this over and over again, it's we're vibrating energy, and it's just constellated into a form that we expect. Like there's a thing called the observer effect, and whatever you expect to see is what you end up seeing. But anyway, so all this material thing, all the material things we see in the material world, you know, again, are forming around our beliefs and expectations, again, because we are all energy. They did that famous double slit experiment where when the scientists were looking at it, expecting it to be solid, these waves would form into solid things. When they expected them to be waves, they would be waves. And this is a famous experiment that everybody talks about. It was Schrodinger and Heisenberg that did these experiments around this. And anyway, so everything we see is energy. So every thought we have sends out an electromagnetic pulse that actually goes out into this big field that we're all connected to and brings it back to us. So it's always affecting. So we're constantly affecting the world around us. Just as the world around us is affecting us, we're all connected in this big, giant field of energy. I mean, that's the truth of the way the world is. And it just looks like we're these separate beings in these separate bodies, but it's actually all energy. If you break it down, even atoms, you break it down, you know, it's mostly all just empty energy.
And how can you find evidence of that our nature being energy in your everyday life?
Well, that's where I did the Einstein wands that I was talking about earlier. So what that is, you hold these wands. I mean, they're made out of, you know, hangers and straw from McDonald's. I mean, again, all these experiments that I talk about are really free or really cheap to do. So anyway, to show it, because, you know, we want proof. We want physical proof. We want to see it out there in the material world. So this was just one way for me to show it. So you put these energy wands in your hands, like as if you're a gunslinging Matt Dillon. I mean, you hold them in front and then you wait till they calm down, because when you first pick them up, they're going to start vibrating again. Your energy, it's, you know, their energy, they're vibrating. So once they calm down and they're pointed straight ahead of you, and then again, you start thinking happy thoughts like, oh, I'm so excited. My daughter's coming home from college this weekend, or, oh, I'm so excited. I'm going to have my favorite dish tonight for dinner, whatever it might be. You start thinking of something good, some great memory, and those wands just go out. So that's your energy. The energy of your thoughts are making those move, because truly we cannot see energy. You know, it is an invisible force, but it's actually more powerful. It's the blueprint for everything that we see in the physical world. This invisible energy is, you know, forms the blueprint. So anyway, that's why I picked that experiment, because that is a way to actually see it. To see it, because, you know, you can't see energy normally, but you can see with these wire wands what the energy does with your thoughts.
And I'm guessing too that that might be why you find group work so useful, because then you're all reinforcing one another's energy field.
Right. With these wands, I have kind of a funny story. There was a woman down in Oklahoma. She went to her dry cleaner and she got 80 sets of hangers. And so she made 40 of these Einstein wands. Well, she took them all around and was having people do them. She took them to a couple medical doctors. She does some intuitive healing. This is down in Oklahoma. In fact, she calls herself the Bible Belt Mystic, which is kind of funny because it's the Bible Belt and people might not believe in some of these principles. But anyway, so she took these wands into a couple medical doctors and they were just blown away at you know, how powerful their thoughts were on this physical thing of this actual wire wand. So anyway, yeah, it's good to see that proof. It really is good to... Wow, this really does work. And it, you know, nothing can convince you quite like that.
When you're in your groups and you're actually doing your intentions in that group setting, do you literally feel something shift for you?
Well, I feel so happy. I mean, I feel like I dance out of those groups. And we don't necessarily do intentions and this kind of work there, although we'll talk about that. Sometimes we'll do some of these experiments. We'll say, okay, this week I'm going to look for this, or this week I'm going to intend to, you know, have this happen. So we will do some of that, but mostly we sit and we talk about this kind of stuff. And again, when you're talking about this with other people and you hear their stories and you're, you know, wow, that's amazing that that happened for you. And then you start, your mind opens up. Again, the world is forming out of your beliefs and expectations. So if your beliefs are really limited and your beliefs are thinking something can't happen, then that's what you're going to realize in your life. So that's why being in these groups and hearing these stories about what's happened for other people helps you. Sorry about that. My phone's ringing.
No big deal.
Then you realize that it could also happen for you. So that's why I think it's important, you know, with the group energy and the group activity.
Yes. And also when you start to worry, doubt, lapse into old patterns and so on, it's so useful to have members of a mastermind or members of a group of supporters remind you of the bigger picture.
Right, exactly. And that's, I think, what happens. And again, when you start out saying, hey, what's going right? When you say, what's right in your world? I mean, that completely changes the conversation. And then you start thinking about what's going right. Another thing I really encourage people to do is to really register in their mind, to stop for a minute and go, wow, everything's okay. Because we tend to register in our consciousness when something's wrong. You know, like, oh, wow, there's a big storm coming, or, you know, whatever might be wrong. But if you stop several times a day, you know, hourly, whatever, and go, wow, you know, everything's really fine right now. There is nothing wrong at this moment. I mean, I believe you should really try to live in the moment. That's one of my challenges. I'm constantly, you know, rushing to the future or thinking about the past, but truly living in the moment, because I believe the atomic now of this moment. But if you really stop and register, wow, everything is really fine right now, and to do that more and more and more, then you start getting more evidence of the fact that, hey, everything is fine, instead of, you know, going from one crisis, one drama to another.
When you're, of course, in that crisis and that drama, and there are always maybe small dramas happening, it is easy to let those completely consume your awareness. And so it takes some real focus. And you talk about the importance of focus to refocus your mind on your goals, on the things you intend, on the positive aspect of your life, and just say no to those persistent negative thoughts.
Right. Just say no. That's good. I like that. Just say no to the negative thoughts.
Give us another couple of examples of people who did this. You've got some wonderful stories in the book of people who applied this and then saw huge shifts happen in either outer wealth, meeting somebody, a new job, a career shift, all kinds of outer manifestations once they made those inner shifts and paid attention. I'd love to hear some more of those stories.
Which story are you thinking about? Because I'm happy to tell you a story. I've got so many, nothing just springs to mind. Is there a particular experiment you'd like me to talk about?
Well, there was one where you had a woman, you talk about a woman who focused on the energy of being wealthy, how being wealthy is a different energy from being poor.
Well, that's really true, for sure. That is true. Oh, it might be talking about the story about Edwene Gaines, perhaps, where when she first got into this. She goes around and gives workshops about this kind of stuff. But when she first got into it, you know, everybody has to start somewhere. Her teacher told her, I don't know if this is a story you're thinking about, they said, make a list of all the things you'd like to, you know, draw into your life. So she quickly did it. You know, I mean, it's not hard to think of things you'd like. So she fills a whole notebook full of things she wanted. One of the things she decided she wanted was a trip to Mexico. She had no idea how she was going to get this trip to Mexico. She had no idea, you know, she knew she didn't have the money to do it, but she, that's what she wanted. And the teacher that was teaching her about these principles said, well, you need to start acting. Or no, she said to her, she goes, well, how are these things going to happen? You know, I don't have the money. I don't have two, you know, dimes to rub together. And she said, well, you need to start acting rich, or start feeling rich, feeling that you do have the means to do these things. So she decided, well, what do rich people do? Or, you know, that question, you know, what would Oprah do? Or what would, you know, a wealthy person do? So she decided that the thing that to her was what wealthy people did is they bought stuffed olives because she was the type that would go to the grocery store and buy beans and rice, you know, and just
buy.
So anyway, so she goes to the store and she pulls out her pocketbook and very carefully, you know, buys these stuffed olives. And then she calls her friend Lana and said, hey, Lana, I'm coming over. We're going to sit by your pool. We're going to drink that bottle of wine that you just got. And we're going to pretend that we're wealthy and that we're in Mexico. So sure enough, Lana, who had no idea what she was talking about, said, sure, come on over. I mean, they were good friends. So she comes over and they sit by the pool and they just had a ball. They're drinking that wine and they're pretending that they're in Mexico and they're talking about all the amazing things they're going to see when they're in Mexico. And you know, so anyway, so they both call the travel agent, and this is back in the days where you did the travel agent and you booked the trip before you paid for it. So they both booked the trip. I mean, they had such a ball talking about their fun trip they were having in Mexico. So a couple weeks later, Lana's mom calls and says, "Hey, you know what? I'd like to pay for your trip to Mexico." And Edwin says, "Hey, I'm the one that was doing the affirmations," because, you know, she was affirming over and over again that, you know, she was going to have these things happen. So anyway, the travel agent calls one day and says, "You know, you need to come down here and pay for this ticket, because otherwise I'm going to have to let it go." And Edwin's, you know, like, "Whoa, what's going on here? How am I going to pay for this?" And then she remembers, you know, that Lana's mom had paid for her. So she thought, "Well, maybe I'll run by my mom's house and, you know, see what's happening there. And maybe my mom will decide to pay for my ticket." So she goes over to her mom's house. She tells her about the big trip to Mexico. And guess what? She says, "Mom, Lana's mom ended up paying for hers." Of course, her mom says, "Well, that's nice. What are you going to do?" So here she is. She says, she's leaving, and, you know, she's giving God a good talking to. And she says, "You know, God, I made these intentions. I did my part. You know, when are you going to show up and do what you're supposed to do here? You know, I'm doing everything this teacher's telling me to do, and I'm affirming that, you know, the world has my back, and I'm affirming that I'm going to Mexico." And just when she was leaving, her mom says, "Hey, honey, would you run out and get the mail for me?" So she, you know, there's a long driveway. She's kicking those stones and kind of cursing under her breath and going, how am I going to get this money to go to Mexico? And, you know, thinking, well, that didn't work. But anyway, so she opens the mailbox, and she had not lived at her mom's house for many, many years. So it was kind of odd. She opens it up, and there's a letter to her, addressed to her at her mom's house. And it's from a return address she doesn't recognize. And she's thinking, well, what in the world is this? She opens the letter. It's from a friend of hers, an old roommate of hers, who had gotten married. That's why she didn't recognize the name, the return address. And here's what the letter said. "Dear Edwin, you and I, when we lived together, we had worked so hard to furnish that apartment. You know, we, you know, decorated in what they called early Salvation Army. But, you know, I recently got married. I wanted you to know. And I sold a lot of that furniture because, you know, Edwin had gone around the world and left everything there." So anyway, she goes, I wanted you to know that I sold all that furniture, and I didn't feel right about keeping this money because, you know, we had worked so hard, you know, to furnish that apartment. And enclosed is your part of the money that I made on that furniture that we sold from that old apartment. And it was exactly the amount that she needed to buy the ticket plus an extra $100.
That is an amazing story. The other thing I like about that story is that it often doesn't come through the person or in the form we expect. And I found this has been so true many times in my own life that I think it's going to manifest or show up through somebody or in some way. And it does show up, but often in a completely different way. And unless I had done that thing that I thought was the direction, like going to your mom's house, then, of course, she wouldn't have been there to open the mail that day just before she had to pay for the ticket.
Right. In fact, I think that's one of the biggest mistakes a lot of us make is we decide how it's going to happen. I mean, the field of infinite potentiality is so much bigger than anything we can come up with. In fact, you know, we're kind of limited in what our thoughts are. So the more we let go of our beliefs about the way it's going to happen, you know, how is not up to me. You know, you set it and forget it again, that you make that intention and then you just trust. And the less you say, like, here's a classic example where it says, "Oh, I want to win the lottery." Well, that's fine, and you might win the lottery, but that really does tie this force's hands behind its back. That gives it one avenue with which to work. If the intention would be, "I would like to, you know, feel abundant," or "I would like to, you know, not feel worried about money," or, you know, something that's a little bit bigger, then all kinds of answers could happen. You know, when you tell it one little thing, this is the way it's got to work, that puts your imprint on it instead of letting it do its beautiful magic. So I think it's the universe, how you want it to work. Let it do its thing. The universe, God, whatever you want to call it. I mean, there's so many different names for this force that is, you know, very real out there in the world.
Yeah. And just having those intentions and then being open to it being even grander or bigger than you expect is very powerful. But then how specific should we get about our desires?
Well, I believe, like, I have four main intentions in life, you know, and everything kind of comes from that. And they're I guess you could say, pretty general. And the one of them is peace of mind. The second one is surety of purpose. The third one is clear, unmistakable guidance. And then the fourth one is unceasing joy. I mean, those are my four main intentions. And then every now and then I'll have a smaller intention, like, okay, I want, like, I just finished the follow-up book to E Squared. So of course my intention was to get that, you know, ready and to, you know, to work on that, finish that up. Also the intention that a lot of people would enjoy it, that it would be helpful to people. So I tend to do kind of broad intentions, trusting. Again, I'm a student of the Course in Miracles, trusting that the universe, the God, whatever you want to call it, has a lot more wisdom and a lot more connections than I do. So I tend to keep my intentions somewhat general, except for every now and then when there's something, you know, specific that I might want. But, you know, wherever you're putting your attention is what you're going to get. And I believe I want the big picture, you know, the big picture of the peace and the joy, you know, and the love and the abundance. But as far as the specifics of how that's going to be, again, I might be limited in what I can come up with. So I, you know, the more I can turn over and give to the higher force that knows a lot more than me, I think the better it is.
Yes, and of course, the vision that higher source has for you, the list of possibilities that higher source has for you, the vision that higher source has of your potential is often far greater than the goals, the visions, and the possibilities you have in your own limited human mind. And so the more you can let go of those and let the universe think through you, the better.
Right. That is so true. In fact, you said most of the time, I would argue all of the time that the universe has a much bigger picture and a bigger plan than you can come up with, for sure. Not yeah. You personally, but, you know, most everybody, all humans.
I'd love you to tell us the story of how you became a writer, because there you were in the middle of the country feeling so limited with this big, long list of mental reasons why it couldn't happen. And then it did happen. What was the process?
Well, I've always been a writer. I mean, from the time I was in second grade, I've been a writer. What wasn't happening for me and where I use these principles is getting someone to pay attention to my writing. So the writing part wasn't really the problem. I've always loved to write. I've always been creative. I've always had no problem sitting down and producing, you know, almost anything. I mean, that part's easy for me. That was, I believe, a natural gift of mine. What wasn't happening living here in Kansas was getting the attention of New York editors. So, I, you know, was trying everything, you know, sending off queries, doing all the things I knew how to do, but I think I did still have some mental blocks. Again, I'm in Kansas. Well, how am I going to get the attention of a New York editor? You know, how am I going to make this happen? But one of the mental changes that had to happen is that first I got it that, you know, I have something important to say. You have to believe that. You have to shift that attitude that I have what these editors need. I have what you know, what they need to fill their magazines, what they need to put in their books. So you have to get that really clear that you do have something to say. But the process that I did, I read this book called Write for Your Life, and it was a book written by Larry Block, who used to go around and give these seminars. Well, for a very short time, he's a mystery writer, and he used to write a column in Writer's Digest. But for a while, he and his wife, you know, trotted around the country doing these seminars. And then he wrote a book once he decided to quit doing the seminars. But one of the things he suggested was to send yourself a postcard every day with some affirmation. And you literally sent it through the mail. And so I did 30 days of this. And it was like, I, Pam, have, you know, important things to say. Or I, Pam, have, you know, can make it as a writer. I don't even remember now what those 30 were. And as I said in the book, I think the postman probably thought I was nuts, you know, sending myself postcards. Like, wait a minute, these postcards are coming from her, going back to her. But again, it's that shifting the energy, that energy from how is anybody going to want what I have to say to what I have to say is important and somebody out there needs to hear it. So there's many techniques for changing that. But again, the world is going to form around your beliefs and expectations. So our job really is to inwardly to change our inner beliefs and expectations. And one of the metaphors I like to use is you don't look in a mirror and say, oh, wow, I need to shave, or, oh, wow, my lipstick is smudged, and then try to do that on the mirror. You know that if you want to, you know, unsmudge your lipstick or shave or whatever it is you're wanting to do as you look in the mirror, you do it on yourself. And that really is the truth of how the world's going to appear for you. You do the inner work and then the outer work changes.
So what was the first big outer evidence you had that your postcard technique and your startling your postman was actually working?
Well, the first assignment that I got from a big magazine was Modern Bride, which that magazine doesn't even exist anymore. But that was such a thrill for me. And I was pretty young at that time. And that might have been even before I started doing the postcards. But here I was sending out all these query letters, and, you know, I wasn't getting much of a response. But I did send in a query letter to, and this is back in the day where everything went through the mail. You know, you put the self-addressed stamped envelopes in there. And so I sent out a query to this editor at Modern Bride, and somehow through the slush pile, she picked it out and made it an assignment. And so again, then my beliefs and expectations grew at that moment, like, wow, maybe this is possible. So so that was the first big one, was Modern Bride. My first travel article was for Ladies Home Journal. It really wasn't even pitched as a travel article. Again, the universe knows more than me, because now I love doing travel writing. It's one of my, you know, big things. But anyway, I had sent a query to her about being a freelance writer, and I had mentioned that I'd just been to Nicaragua to pick coffee and that I'd been to Jamaica and stayed in a villa. And so she calls me up and says, "Do you do travel writing? You know, I noticed from your query." And I, of course, you never say no to an editor. So I, you know, shake my head and go, "Oh, yes, I do travel writing." And she says, "Well, where are you going next?" And I wasn't going anywhere, but a friend of mine was going to Tampa. So I said, "Well, I'm going to Tampa in a couple weeks." And she says, "Okay." And she gave me an assignment about Tampa. So I call my friend. I go, "Can I go to Tampa with you?" So anyway, you know, that happened where they came to me. You know, that came to me. In fact, one of the things I like to talk about too is this travel writing. You know, a lot of people have that intention that they want to travel. And I was no different than anybody else. I wanted to travel. That was my intention. I didn't have the funds or the means, at least in the material world, to make that happen. But most people, you know, they think, okay, I want to travel. So they, you know, work at a job and they save up their money and they think they're going to retire and then they're going to travel. But I knew I didn't know how to do it, but I knew that I wanted to do it. And again, how's that up to me? So then I kind of fell into this travel writing career. I mean, in the last year, I've been to Kenya, I've been to Namibia, I've been to the Dominican Republic, I've been to the Cook Islands. I mean, I travel all over the world as a travel writer. So whether or not I had the means, and I mean, I stay in 5-star hotels, I get to meet the most amazing people, I get to do the best things, go to the best restaurants. And so again, if I'd have been trying to plan that out, I'd have been on Travelocity probably, and trying to figure out, you know, the 2-star hotel I could possibly afford, you know, that kind of a thing. But the universe, which has a much bigger plan, you know, pushed me into travel writing. And of course, that has led me on all kinds of amazing adventures.
Now, the universe pushing you in that direction is something you talk about in the book quite a bit. You talk about guidance, our inner guidance system. How do people who haven't used it, who haven't even been sure they have one, start to get in touch with it? And how do you separate guidance from all the other voices in your head? And I know there's a whole bunch of questions, but let's go ahead and take one at a time. So there's this phenomenon of guidance. How do you recognize it? How do you listen to it? And then how do you sort it out?
Well, the thing I used to always say is, oh, I wish God worked in neon, you know, because like everybody else, you know, which guidance is mine or which guidance is from the universe? But I think for me, as I've become clearer and clearer in my intentions and more faithfully looking for joy and expecting, you know, gifts and blessings, the guidance becomes clearer all the time. So, I don't know, because it's funny now that I'm thinking about this, reflecting on this, I used to, like I said, I always would say the thing about why doesn't God work in neon? Because I too often wondered what is mine to do and, you know, what's the way to go? But I don't see that as much now. So again, I'm focused on, you know, those four big intentions, and I'm, you know, trusting that the universe is going to only send good my way. So I don't know. I don't have so many of those guidance issues as I used to have, but okay, the question was, how do you know? I think, and if you aren't used to using it, here's what I think. I think we're constantly getting guidance, and that's why I think these experiments are so good, because you realize that, you start seeing it. But, and I think another thing that happens is we get so much guidance and we tend to just blank it out. You know how if you have a dream at night and you wake up, if you don't write it down, you forget it. In fact, then you go back, and sometimes I have had a dream journal, and even, you know, a week later, I'll go back and I'll read my dream journal. I go, wow, I can't even believe I dreamt that. You know, in other words, you blank it all out. So I think that's what we do in our waking conscious mind as well. We tend to blank out a lot of signs, and guidance that's coming our way. So by simply making that intention that you're going to pay attention and to ask for it and to trust that it'll come, and just, again, do a 48-hour experiment. You know, you're still a total skeptic. You think, oh, this is a bunch of hogwash. Well, just try to open your mind for the 48 hours and ask for some kind of a sign and see what happens and really pay attention. You know, say, okay, for 48 hours, I'm going to suspend my skepticism. I'm going to, you know, it's worth that. You know, it's like Pascal's wager. Might as well, for at least these 48 hours, pretend that there really could be some guidance and then pay attention and actively pay attention. And then just see what happens and go ahead and follow that guidance. And then as you begin to see that it works out in your favor, then you get more and more confidence and you're more apt to try it again next time. But again, it's a simple matter of making an intention and following through and giving it a try, opening our mind and opening up our beliefs and expectations, opening to new possibilities.
Yeah, I was talking to one of my friends the other day, and she said that we're talking about synchronicity, and we were talking about how many years ago we used to really notice synchronicities and comment on them, and it was like, wow, that was so synchronous. Now we simply expect synchronicities, and in fact, our lives seem to run entirely on synchronicities rather than having to create them. So it's interesting how you do when you do start to get into that groove and listen for those nudges and then follow them. Suddenly there are nudges everywhere, and then suddenly your whole life seems to be a series of movements that is shifted by those nudges.
Yeah, oh, I know, it's so fun. Like, I one of the chapters in my new book is about, you know, getting messages from nature, from, you know, the natural world as opposed to, you know, on the news or whatever. But anyway, so I had just done that chapter on that, and of course now it's at the publisher, so it's really too late to change it. But two stories came into my awareness just right about that same time. About this guy, and I love this story. He was, you know, really depressed. He'd been in Vietnam. He'd, you know, gotten shot, been sent home, you know, 9 weeks early. And this, again, it's a nature-type story, so I'll go ahead and tell the story that had just come up after I'd written this chapter. So anyway, he was, you know, just felt like nobody paid any attention to him. He was totally alone. He was completely isolating. He was drinking. He was doing drugs. He became a boat builder and finally just built like this 32-foot schooner, and he goes out into the Pacific Ocean all by himself. He's practically crying in tears, almost wishing that a storm would come up, you know, to capsize his boat and end it all. But while he's out there feeling so horrible, this whale, this big 20-foot, 30-foot, whatever whale comes up, swims beside him for 3 or 4 hours. And he said, I don't know how to put it into words, he said, but it felt like I was loved for the first time in my entire life. I felt so loved by that whale. And that whale came up, looked him in the eye. I mean, can you imagine a big whale, probably a big whale eye as big as his head, looked him in the eye, and he said he knew the message was, it's time to go home and be among the living. And this guy has gone on, and he's built this carousel of happiness in Nederland, Colorado. He's a wood carver, you know, he from learning how to build boats. But anyway, so now he's this joyful, wonderful person, but this whale. But anyway, so that was a cool story, because I had just written about this, you know, thing about getting signs from nature, and then I hear that story, and then another story came in just about the same time. So I love that once you start, you know, wanting to know about something, once you start intending something, if you're open and if you're looking, you'll find all kinds of answers. And it's so exciting. I mean, you know, it takes the onus off of us, you know, again, our little pea brains that have been trying so hard to figure everything out.
One of the people you quote in the book occasionally is Abraham Hicks. And one of the quotes you have in the book is the quote that it is as easy to manifest a castle as a button. And that quote happens to be on top of my to-do list. On my to-do list every day, I have sort of big principles, the why up the very top, and then the what is all down below. And that's one of the really powerful ideas for me. And yet, I think most of us do have some kind of built-in limiter in our thinking. We know we can create this much joy, but we are not at all sure about creating that much joy. In fact, one of my personal research interests is endocrinology, and we have hormonal set points, literal set points in our bodies, where we allow ourselves to feel good to a certain degree, but once there's too much serotonin coming in, we literally shrink away from that and shut down those feelings of joy. So most of us in our manifestational abilities as well are okay with manifesting the button, and we're really happy about that. Maybe we have a lot of buttons lying around, but then we're not at all sure about the castle and then how big we might get. And it might even be scary to think about being able to manifest something that's really, really huge. How do you see this scaling issue in manifestation?
Again, it's going to form around your beliefs and expectations. And you're very right. All of us can picture ourselves manifesting a button. That's pretty easy to get your mind around. But the more we can let go of the fact that things are impossible and that anything could be possible, and it really is just as easy. I mean, it says in the Bible, you know, you can move a mountain. I mean, anything like this is possible except for what you yourself won't allow. And so really our job, or instead of saying our work, I like to say you're playing, what we're playing around with is getting rid of those blocks and limitations and expanding whatever box we put ourselves in. I mean, this is kind of something interesting I heard recently. The word fact, you know, we believe this is a fact. It's a fact that I can, you know, get a button. It's a fact that I can't get a castle, or, you know, any other facts. It's a fact I have this cancer. It's a fact that, you know, whatever it might be, we believe these are facts. Fact is actually a Latin word. It originates from a Latin word that means making stuff up. So every fact that we believe is something that we have, it's a limit, it's a box that we have created. We humans, we have created this box. It's no more true than any other fact, but we believe them, and we put all of our beliefs and expectations, we put all of our energy into that being true. So of course it's going to continue to manifest around those beliefs and expectations. So I think what I'm playing with is to open up to more and more possibilities and to eliminating, to driving right through, you know, not just upsetting the apple cart, but literally getting a whole new team of horses.
So you really can go much, much bigger scale than you might expect.
Right. I mean, the Course in Miracles does say that if we suddenly, like if I said, okay, I want a castle and it popped right into my existence, it might scare me. So, you know, it's gentle with us and it works slowly, or you know, it'll work at whatever speed we're willing to do it. Again, it's up to us. It's a reflection of our inner work. So, you know, it doesn't want to scare us. It's gentle. It loves us. This force loves us so much, and it's, you know, just working with us as much as we'll give it to work with. So, the sooner we can get rid of those blocks and walls that we put up, you know, the sooner we can lift the veil, the quicker we're going to be able to see those castles and, you know, the bigger picture.
Now, all of us have areas of our lives that we're strong in and weak in. It just seems to be part of the human condition that there are things that some of us do effortlessly, easily, that are a real struggle for others. I'm thinking about math or exercise or whatever it might be, and other things that we struggle with. They're really hard for us. So in some areas of our lives, perhaps we manifest effortlessly. In others, we really don't. Pam, for you personally, what are some of the areas of your life where you found it harder to either apply this or to see the results?
Well, I personally am trying to eliminate that four-letter word from my vocabulary. I think that's a dangerous word. It's really hard, because as long as you say that and continue to affirm that, then it, you know, will continue to be hard for you. However, I do talk about this. In fact, one of the experiments in the new book, E-Cube, that's coming out in September, is to flip a long-held belief that you've had about yourself, you know, a belief that you've, you know, worn like a pair of favorite blue jeans. One of my beliefs that I'm playing with flipping with right now is that I said I am not a good speaker. And, you know, I'm an author. This is my 17th book. So obviously, as an author, you're asked to speak. People want you to speak. But I've always believed, you know, that was my limitation, my little box. Well, I'm not a good speaker. But in the quantum world, the fact that I could be an excellent, amazing speaker is every bit as true as this story that I've been saying over and over again. Well, I'm not a good speaker. I'm a writer, not a speaker. So lately, I've been called on to speak really all over the world. You know, this book has been, you know, translated into 30 languages. I'm going to Australia. I've been to England and Germany. I'm going to Finland. I'm going to Mexico next week. I mean, so I'm speaking all over the place. So, but that was a box that I had put myself in. And again, as long as I continue to, you know, chuck stones into that bucket that I'm not a good speaker, then I would, you know, create that reality. So I literally have to draw from the big field of potentiality, the big possibility field, that I am an excellent speaker, that I'm as good a speaker as anybody else, you know, that I have a lot to say. Again, you have to believe that you have that to say. So I guess to kind of answer your question is I try not to use that word hard, because it's a danger. I think it's a dangerous four-letter word. and I prefer to affirm smooth and easy. Again, it that might seem more like a castle than me being a great speaker than a button for me, but it's certainly possible. And I'm getting evidence all the time that I am a good speaker. I've already done, you know, three or four of these, you know, in front of people. And, you know, so I'm getting evidence to support that particular belief right now.
And of course, as you get the evidence, you believe more strongly, and it becomes a virtuous cycle. Well, just in closing, Pam, I so appreciate your work, and I know that you are going to speak to many, 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 many more millions of people, and they will be so blessed, moved, and touched by your work. What is one experiment that people, our listeners, can do in the next couple of days that will at least give them a starter dose of understanding the power of their thoughts and their intentions to shape their reality?
Well, I like to start with the one that I start with in the book, and that is, I call it the dude abides principle, and that there is this force, this loving, invisible force that is looking out for you, that does love you, that does have your back. So I start out with that one and say, people give 48 hours. Again, it jars us into paying attention. This force is always there, but we're not paying attention. But it jars us into paying attention for the next 48 hours. Just ask for some kind of really clear, unmistakable sign that there is a force out there that has your back. So just ask people to do that. You know, 48 hours, I would jot down the time, like whatever the time it is you're listening to this, and then, you know, jot down 48 hours from now, and then just look for the next, you know, couple days and see what kind of signs you might get. That's kind of the initial one that gets people started. I call it the dude abides.
And those signs would be unmistakable.
That they would be unmistakable, that you cannot, you know, write it off as coincidence. People will try to write it off as coincidence oftentimes, but let's ask for something that you will be unable to do that with.
One of my favorite sayings is from Napoleon. He said, never, as the commanding general of your army, never issue an order that anybody can understand. Issue an order that nobody can possibly misunderstand. And I think that's what I recommend to people looking for guidance. As I say, make sure that you ask for a sign that is so clear that you can't possibly misunderstand that it's guidance speaking.
Oh, that's great. I love it.
Well, I am just already visualizing you speaking to massive crowds who are jumping up and down, cheering, hollering, being inspired, and also feeling the lightness in your work. What I so enjoyed about this book and the others is that you have such a sense of play and whimsy about the way you write. And we all get caught up in that as we read your work and as we hear you. So thank you so much for sharing your light approach to life as well.
Oh yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been great.
Pam, you're a gem, and I know we'll talk again. I'm really grateful to you for sharing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.